This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
I'm Pat Sensen. This is the podcast edition of And the Winner Is. On this week's program, part one of Afghanistan, The Sky Cries Blood. The story of Afghanistan is one of conflict and hardship. In 1979, the Soviet Union invaded and occupied Afghanistan. By 1989, the Soviets were driven out by anti-communist Mujahideen forces. And by the late 90s, the Taliban emerged as Afghanistan's dominant force. Then, in October 2001, a month after the September 11th attacks on the United States, an American-led coalition invaded Afghanistan, driving out the Taliban government. CBC correspondents Connie Watson and the late David McLaughlin were there to report on the start of that war. And several months later, they returned to Afghanistan, seeing the country from a different perspective. They returned to a country ravaged by war, working in areas where there was no electricity, no heat, and no running water. The stories they brought back to Canada culminated in a three-part special series called Afghanistan, The Sky Cries Blood. It was originally broadcast in April 2002. Through music, poetry, folktales, soundscapes, and discussion, the series explored the challenges of trying to emerge from three decades of war and told the story of Afghanistan through the words of the ordinary people living there. Afghanistan, The Sky Cries Blood, was awarded a Gold World Medal at the 2003 New York Festivals. It was also the winner of a UN Gold Plaque for, quote, reflecting the global concerns of the United Nations, including human rights, literacy, crime, and violence, and the fight against poverty. Over the next 3 weeks, we'll present all three parts of Afghanistan, The Sky Cries Blood. Today, in part one, we begin on the streets of Kabul.
I'm Connie Watson. To get a sense of what life is really like in Kabul, pile into the nearest vehicle. Now, chances are the steering wheel will be on the right, like the British, but the driver will pull onto the right-hand side of the road, like Canadians. Your driver doesn't shoulder check. He just pulls into traffic with his faith in Allah. Then he starts leaning on his horn and steering with his head stuck out the window because he can't see through his windshield. He has a poster of his martyred war hero plastered across that. Now he drives the wrong way down a one-way street, and the other drivers, who you would think would blow their horns, just move over to make room. And forget about the frontline soldiers. The bravest men in this country are the traffic cops. They stand in the middle of the gridlocks, and the screaming drivers, armed with only a whistle and a stop sign the size of a saucer. Heading out of the city, it's a different world. Afghanistan's nomads, the Kuchi people, are on the move, heading from the south where they've spent the winter to the north where the grass is already turning the hills green. They drive their herds along the roads. The animals stop to graze. The sheepdogs drop to the ground for a rest. The donkeys carry the load. One little burro has the big cooking pot and the kettle piled on its back. Another has blankets and wood. The others carry lambs and kid goats, who are too little to walk such a long way. They ride the donkeys about five in a bunch, bundled so securely only their necks and heads stick out. Can I take a picture of you? I ask the nomads if I can take a few photos of their caravan. They stop for me, gathering together under a tree. I notice one man has pink plastic where his leg used to be. The color stands out against the deep bronze of his skin. He must have walked hundreds of kilometers on that thing. He'll be walking hundreds more before he stops.
I'm David McLaughlin. What amazes me on this trip to Afghanistan is the unexploded bombs, landmines, warheads, all kinds of munitions and rockets lying around.
Come here.
And the teams of people trying to find them and defuse them or detonate them before someone else does by mistake. I'm in Herat. It's 1,000 kilometers west of Kabul, near the Iran border. I'm walking with Ahmed Zai. He's a demining officer.
Our job is just clearance up minefields.
A few blocks away, there's a big explosion. Nobody pays much attention. It's a fact of life here in town, out in the farmers' fields, where kids play, where you walk, where you drive. I'm sitting in a room with about 20 people. We're having a big meal, rice and chicken. Then outside, another explosion, a short distance away. Everyone goes kind of quiet. Then I hear this sound like a chicken. Kids look at each other, then... And one of the kids smiles. I look around, and one of the men has a twinkle in his eye. Then the chicken really starts talking. I realize the man with the chicken noises just wants to take people's minds off the explosion. To me, that's the whole reason for being here, just to record the common, unremarkable experiences and to see where Afghans find the encouragement they need to recover in their culture, their faith, their history, and their sense of humor.
Surely you've heard of Mullah Nasruddin. Children in Afghanistan grow up hearing Mullah Nasruddin stories, just as you in America hear tales of Mother Goose. The mullah is supposed to be a revered teacher and leader, but usually he turns out to be the village idiot. Here's one of his stories called Mullah and the Bandit. One day, Mullah Nasruddin went on a journey, his steps taking him across a dangerous bandit-infested valley. For protection, he carried a gun in one hand and a sword in the other. Halfway across the valley, a robber stopped him, went through his pockets, and ran off with his valuables. A passerby who witnessed the spectacle said, "Mullah, what is wrong with you? Why didn't you stop him?" "Ah," said Mullah Nasruddin, "if I hadn't had my hands full, the fellow would never have gotten away with it."
Millions of Afghans are in exile. Some of the 50,000 Afghans in Toronto recently celebrated spring by taping a concert to send to Radio Afghanistan in Kabul. They talked to us about yearning for a country they can't go back to.
I left Afghanistan after I saw about 16 dead bodies with my own eyes in my street. Two of them had the heads cut from their bodies completely. That was the time I felt there wasn't any safety at all. So I decided to leave the country to survive and serve my people when it is possible. I didn't leave my country until I felt there wasn't even a small chance of survival.
I'm not enjoying life here because they are my people. We cannot eat properly. Because suddenly thinking comes, do they have anything to eat? Does he have any doctor? Does he have any medicine? Those people, they are lucky if they are killed at once. We are unlucky because we are dying every moment till the Afghanistan is getting better.
I left Afghanistan after the completion of my education. It was 1988. I've studied law. I love to go back inside the boundary of Afghanistan. I don't mind where. We have to wait for some more years. But we are very optimistic and we should be.
The Clock, a poem by Musa Marufi. In our kitchen in Vienna, a clock ticks. Its handle heralds the time moving forward. In our kitchen in Kabul, a clock ticks. Its handle heralds the time, moving backward. The first adores the future. The second worships history. Both moving fast, they pull the time in opposite directions. But the time is running away in search of the present. Alas, by the time it finds the present will be history.
My name is Rahmatullah Meher. I'm the advisor to the minister and head of the economic department of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Kabul. Put yourself in my position. When you lose everything, including your country, your identity, the most important thing that a refugee loses is his identity. I never forget at the beginning of my refugee status, in all papers that I used to fill in the immigration department, they put just stateless. It was like a shock to me.
Walk into any little Afghan shop in any Afghan community in North America, and there's a story. I stopped into this one in Toronto. Its shelves are stacked with CDs and cassettes, China plates, maps, pictures, and souvenirs. The owner is Shabir Alakuzi. His family operated a music shop in Kabul before they came to Canada. His parents and cousins, all but one of his brothers, live in Toronto now. One brother is a refugee in Peshawar, Pakistan. I told Shabir I was on my way to Afghanistan and I'd be stopping in Peshawar. Shabir asked me if I'd take a message to his brother, Nazir. It's a warning to his brother. Be careful. Don't join political groups. You know what happens. Think about yourself and your family. I wondered, why the warning?
My brother's kidnapped like 4 months ago in Peshawar. Because he knows, the people knows he was the supporter of King Zahir. And when they capture him, they ordered like $25,000. But he doesn't know about the person who's kidnapped, but he was all eyes is covered, and he doesn't know about the kidnapper, but he's good now. But he changed his home and everything.
When his brother Nazir was kidnapped, his wife had to sell everything they owned to pay the ransom. It was $1,000. Shabir says his brother is just plain lucky to be alive.
The point is, over there, anyone have a gun. And if you be against each other, might be it's happened to my brothers also, as I told him to stay and help him and help the government, help the people and help the United Nations. Don't be standing any political groups. Just be your, think about yourself, your families and your businesses. You work with own peoples, Afghani peoples. This is my point.
I agreed to take the message to his brother.
از سرزمین کانادا از طرف این حقیر فقیر عبدالله نوابی شادکام.
I left Canada with a special recorded message too. Mine was from Abdullah Nawabi, who lives in Toronto. In Afghanistan, he's known as Shad Khan, a singing star who had a show on Radio Afghanistan. He wanted me to find his old friend, Mohammed Siddiq, who protected the radio archives through the Civil War and the Taliban times.
سلامتی و جانجوری و آبادی ملک و وطن را پیوسته آرزو داشتیم و دارم خداوند با شما باد.
اسم قاسم بخش
اسلام محمد شریف طبل نواز رادیو تلویزیون.
Here are some musicians in Peshawar, Pakistan. It's just across the border from Afghanistan. Peshawar became a cultural center for musicians and artists fleeing the Taliban. There's enough work for these musicians, playing weddings and social gatherings. Later in the program, they'll talk about how the Taliban tried to silence their music, how they smashed their instruments and threw them in jail. The leader's name is Kazim Bakhsh. Everybody knows him in Kabul. They're all waiting in Peshawar for the right time to return. They think it'll be soon. The song, composed by Kazim Bakhsh, is an invitation for the people of the world to come back to Afghanistan.
کابل است چراغان زیارت تایش فراوان کابل است چراغان زیارت تایش فراوان زامن کابل زمین عاشقان و عارفان، زامن کابل زمین عاشقان و عارفان.
By the name of Allah, I want to say you welcome to this party that has held for March 8th, the International Day of Women. Thank you for your love.
Little girls in traditional costumes welcome the crowd. The seats are filled with foreign dignitaries, diplomats, hand-picked local women. The VIPs are here in Kabul to mark the end of a regime that forced women out of their jobs, out of the schools, and into their all-enveloping burqas. The Afghan women are here for the lunch. Everyone gets a piece of chicken, flatbread, a hard-boiled egg, and an orange. The women comb the floor, looking for leftovers. Then each one slips on her burqa and slips away.
If some woman shows her face, others stare at her with anger and hatred, questioning her with their eyes. How dare she take off her burqa and show her face?
Makarama is a judge who's just returned to her job. What we call a burqa, the women of Afghanistan call a chadari.
So when we go to our office, we wear the burqa. When we reach our office, then we take it off. And we are doing this because we are just waiting for the situation to get more normal.
My name is Munira Qarizade Muazzin. My father's name is Qari Muhammad Ayub Muazzin. I'm in high school, Aisha Drani, at the 11th class.
Munira is young and beautiful. She says she wears her burqa for her own safety. And besides, she's used to it. Another young single woman says it protects her from leering eyes and unwanted marriage proposals. The city of Kabul is still a sea of blue burqas. Most women are comfortable with their cloak of anonymity. Pashtun Madaber is not. Pashtun sits behind her ancient wooden desk. She's the principal of Aisha Drani School in Kabul. And right now, her office is bedlam. Pupils and teachers with torn bits of ragged paper dodge past the little man who's waving a big stick at the doorway. In between signing, stamping, and double-checking all the paperwork, she tells her story.
From the first day when this government came into power, I took off my burqa. We have public washrooms in Afghanistan that are very dark. They have no light. So when you come out suddenly, the sunshine hits your eyes and everything is bright. It was like that for me. I felt a lot of brightness and everything was clear in front of me when I took off my burqa. Nobody said anything to me except a little boy who said, "Where is your translator?" By that he meant, "I'm not an Afghan because I'm not wearing a burqa." But of course, he knew that I'm Afghan. He was teasing me. I was not nervous about taking off my burqa because I was dreaming of this. So when you wish for something, when the time comes, you don't feel really scared to do it.
چادری نمی پوشم من بریش نمی جوشم گفت خاموش میخروشم چون سبو بر دوشم چادری نمی پوشم.
I don't want to put on the burqa, Mukaddesa repeats. The poet hates her burqa. She writes defiantly about refusing to even put it on, sees it as a symbol of destruction, illiteracy, intolerance, violence, darkness, and misery. Women from offices and schools were driven away like the light from the night. Manners, intelligence, knowledge were not taught in schools. I don't want to put on the burqa. I am imprisoned in my own house. I cannot go anywhere. I was forced to marry. What sufferings I had to bear. I don't want to put on the burqa. After reciting her poem, Mukaddesa unzips her purse and pulls out her burqa. She perches it on her head so that it cascades down her back like a veil. Then she pulls the mesh down over her sad eyes and heads home.
We're driving to Maslak camp from Herat. We pass a mine-clearing detail. Seven men in battle fatigues that have been out with their mine detectors. Now they've identified where the mines have been placed and need to be exploded. Half a kilometer beyond the men, farther out into the flat field, is a farmer working with his ox. The further we drive, the more people we find. A little girl with a red dress, picking small stones and putting them in a can. A boy wrapped in a turban, pulling a wheelbarrow, heading in the direction of Herat. It's already been a 30-minute drive for us. It'll be an all-day walk for the boy with the wheelbarrow.
What is this we are looking at?
This is the graveyard that the Maslak people, when they their children or their wife or husbands die, and they are putting into the land. It belongs to the Maslak camp, this graveyard.
The houses are round, gray mounds of mud that have been constructed over the years by the people here. This is an administration building. Dust continues to blow, 6 or 8 feet of dust just in the morning wind, indicating just how dry this area is.
What goes in here?
This is the food of refugee people. They are cooking flour, sugar, oil.
There's four large cauldrons being heated over flames of oil. Tiny children in sweaters and embroidered dresses carrying plastic containers that once held cooking oil, now they hold gruel for the feeding of the people.
My
name is Said Bibi.
One
of my sons died because of lack of food. It's about 4 days he has been died in Maslak camp.
I'm sorry to hear this.
My name is Kadir Ahmed. I'm a pediatrician in this clinic. It is near Herat province, and there are the displaced people from different provinces of Afghanistan, like Ghor, Faryab, and Badghis. Our people, God says to help the other people. And we have an expression that God likes people who help each other.
I have heard that in my land, the night is afraid of the stars, the trees of the moon, the day of the sun, the rivers of the water. I have heard that in my land, hopes seek refuge in shrouds, beggars in homes of the famished. Fathers in their wheat dreams sleep on a harvest spot. I have heard that houses are wounded, with nobody to cover the open scars of the walls, and the streets scream in pain when sounds of bombs and rockets break the bones of the window panes. I have heard that lambs eat human flesh in place of grass, and tomorrow signifies nothing other than a hen thinking of laying an egg.
Plastic tarps flap in the wind of the Somali plains. Tents staked so close together, they share the same pegs. Inside are the survivors, the returnees, They've come home to their village of Karabakh. But it isn't here anymore. There's only dust and rubble. The widow Sima invites me inside her tent.
Let's go, we are both alone.
Are we?
Yeah.
Salam
alaikum. My husband was killed during the Taliban's time. He was in the prison for 6 months. And he was beaten up a lot by common sticks and things that they were using, some cable wires and these things they were using to beat up the people. And he died. So now she is for 3 years a widow woman, and she's the mother of 8 children in this camp.
At this point in her story, her screaming toddler is dropped inside the tent. Sima doesn't miss a beat. She grabs the boy, and without even glancing at him, she pulls him under her wrap and soothes him.
My house, the plot that I used to live at, is just a few meters away from here, but it's completely damaged and destroyed, and you only can find the dust of my previous house. We are running out of everything. We don't have any food. You know, 8 children that I have, and 5 or 6 of them can walk and can bake something. It is too difficult for us to find some corn to eat or something to eat, right? And we have no dishes. If we have dish to cook something, we have no bowls to eat at. And if we have bowls to eat, we don't have any dishes. We have nothing.
There is no sign this tent is home to a family of 9. No clothes, no shoes, no pots, nothing but a few flat cushions on the plastic that covers the ground.
Though we have come back to our area, we do not have enough money to rebuild our destroyed and damaged house. We have no fields to work on. We have no money to make a business with. I have no man to help me. We have no income. So if the international community does not pay any attention to us, I don't think if we would have any future, we will die soon.
Sima points at her oldest son. He sits at the far end of the tent. He's no more than 10 years old. She asks, how is he supposed to help sow a crop or build a house? Sharin Aha is the head of this settlement. He says nearly half of the 183 families who returned here are headed by widowed women. Sharin says aid organizations promised to build every family here a 2-room house.
But they haven't implemented yet, and I don't think if they would implement it, because all Afghanistan is almost immigrants, and all Afghanistan is almost, you know, damaged.
As I leave, an old man chops a gnarled tree root that will go in tonight's fire. Another tree ripped out of Afghanistan's soil. A tree that likely came from what's left of the nearby orchard. A tree that will be ashes in an hour or two.
An Aryan creation story. In the beginning was nothing. Neither heaven nor earth nor space in between. Then non-being became spirit and said, "Let me be." In those early times, humanity was created with everlasting life. But soon the world became overcrowded because humankind lived forever like the gods. So Dias Petar decided to make humankind mortal. And he created the goddess, Death. At first, Death was reluctant to carry out the task assigned her, but she finally did so, while weeping. Her tears were diseases that brought death at an appropriate time. To create more death, the goddess created desire and anger in people, emotions that led to their killing each other.
The city of Peshawar in Pakistan. Millions of Afghan refugees have come through here since the late 70s, and many have stayed. The back streets are jammed with Afghan shops and choked with traffic. I'm bringing a message from a man in Toronto named Shabir Alakuzi. He hasn't seen his brother, Nazir, for 10 years. I find Nazir Alakuzi in a tiny, crowded shop in a back street. My name's Nazir Alakuzi. I'm the Afghan juice man. His juice shop is the size of a walk-in closet. 24 people are jammed inside. He begins to introduce them.
Ahmad Munib.
And is he your boy?
He's my son.
And then?
Sirajuddin.
Siraj.
He's my cousin.
Everyone seems to be related.
He also has cousin.
Nazir tells me that for Afghans, there's nothing more important than family.
He's my uncle. He's his daughter.
Her name is Sunya.
He listens to the sound of his brother's voice from Toronto. He tells me he's so glad to hear it. The message, don't take sides in political groups. All the divisions in the society are too dangerous for you. It got you kidnapped and nearly killed. Nazir tells me the kidnapping was a nightmare.
During 2 months, I haven't seen the moon event, the human face, and that affects everything.
He says he wasn't kidnapped for political reasons. The kidnappers thought he had family in Toronto who'd be rich enough to pay a high ransom. But his family didn't pay the ransom, I remind him. That doesn't matter, he says. He tells me his wife sold everything they had, paid some of the ransom, and then he escaped. And he's alive, and that's all that counts. I ask him if he's angry with his family in Canada because they didn't help him out. He says, no, he doesn't blame them. Anyway, it's time to pray, and most of the guys have left the shop.
I'm Selig Harrison, the author of Out of Afghanistan, the inside story of the Soviet withdrawal. The boundaries of Afghanistan today and the ethnic makeup of Afghanistan today is a direct legacy of what historians and novelists call the Great Game, when the British in the 19th century were concerned about Russia moving down into the Indian subcontinent, where the Raj, of course, was established. So, you know, Afghanistan had only been in existence since 1747 as a tribal confederacy of the Pashtun tribes of Afghanistan, when the British in 1823 decided that to keep the Indian Raj secure, they had to push the boundaries of it up to the Khyber Pass. And in doing that, they took away 40,000 square miles of what had been the original state of Afghanistan, going up to the Indus River, past the Khyber Pass, up to the Indus River, which, of course, included about half of the Pashtuns who had been in the original tribal confederacy. The British wanted a buffer state in Afghanistan against Russian expansion, so they encouraged what was left of Afghanistan, this Pashtun state on the other side of the Khyber, to annex the ethnic minority regions to the north. The British said to the Afghan rulers, go at it, boys, go up north and co-opt the Tajik areas, the Hazaras, the Uzbeks, the ethnic groups between the Pashtun, original Pashtun areas, and the Oxus River. What resulted, of course, was an ethnic divide between the original Pashtun tribal base of the country in the south and the east, and these annexed areas of Tajiks, Hazaras, Uzbeks, Turkomans. And I think that the story of Afghanistan ever since has really been a story of the tensions between this Pashtun group that thought we're the original, the pure Afghans, who wanted to linguistically and culturally and in every other way make Afghanistan a Pashtun society, and the minorities who wanted to assert their position on an equitable basis. And the monarchy was a Pashtun monarchy, the monarchy of Zahir Shah, which lasted until 1973 when he was overthrown. It was nominally Pashtun. He did try to pursue enlightened policies toward the minorities, and you had a kind of uneasy ethnic balance in the country, but with lots of undercurrent of tension. And, of course, the British had built in a basic tension between Afghanistan and Pakistan, because they had taken away in 1823 and then formalized in 1893 half of the Pashtun population, which had become part of the British Raj. And when Pakistan was created in 1947, the British handed over this area, this Pashtun area, to the new state of Pakistan, which, of course, Afghanistan didn't accept. And you have there something which is an irredentist issue built into the relationship between Pakistan and Afghanistan ever since.
About 100 tribal elders wash their hands at an outdoor tap and then sit down for tea on carpets spread across a courtyard in Peshawar. This is Afghanistan's past and future meeting in exile. These leaders represent tribes from every region of the country. They are the only alternative to the warlords. Men like these ran the country in spite of Afghanistan's internal divisions, that is, until the Soviet invasion, the Civil War, and the Taliban. When there was a national decision to be made, they held a Loya Jirga, or Grand Council. In the last century, 3 Loya Jirgas were called. One man participated in all 3. He's Senator Ghulam Nabi Chiknauri. His village was destroyed in the war. He and many of his people moved to Pakistan. Now he lives in Peshawar. In his white robe and scarf, his long white beard, he exudes a kind of otherworldly calm.
Loya Jirga, or the Grand Council, has its own tradition in Afghanistan for big problems or problems of higher scale, which are in larger scale. And whatever problem there has been, mostly it has been resolved by the Loya Jirga or the Grand Council.
The problems of the last century involved the Second World War and, later, modernization of the Afghan state. The senator remembers each meeting required months of discussion to arrive at a decision.
The success of these were actually that the first Loya Jirga, which was in 1941, and the second one was that we approved the Afghan government treaty with the Russians. And the third Grand Council actually approved the amendments to the Constitution. And there were different political parties which came into existence.
Senator Chiknauri and his friends sitting around this courtyard compose an important part of Afghanistan's tribal ruling class in exile. They're cautious about the outcome of the Loya Jirga planned in Afghanistan for this spring. We'll hear more about what's at stake later in the program.
Friday prayers at the Herat Mosque in Kabul. People file in to hear the weekly message from Mullah Abdul Rauf. Over the loudspeakers, he tells the faithful to be better Muslims. 23 years, the message hasn't changed. Neither has Mullah Rauf, even though he's been thrown in jail 11 times. The mullah welcomes me to a Spartan room in the mosque to show me the scars on his hands and legs from the torture.
The worst memory that I have was I had to preach for half an hour, but the government's preacher came and started to preach very political way, not in Islamic way. He started and took 25 minutes of mine. When he went out, I had just only 5 minutes. I just went to the microphone and said, he has read a poem about that. When you didn't do anything for your God, what would you do for your people? Nothing. That's all I said. And they started to make a big case for me, and they just started chasing me and knocked my door. And I was, you know, put in one of the rooms for 60 days that I could never see the face of the sun. And then they put me in another jail for 60 days, then started, you know, to pull out my the meat of my legs, and to pull out my nails from my fingers and these things. And then I was carried through the Bulcharhi jail, which is very famous, and I was put there for a long time. This is the worst memory that I have.
Mullah Rauf laughs at the end of his story. He laughs all the time. He's a happy man. The mullah says the Taliban didn't like him either. They shut him down after he accused them of not practicing the true Islam.
Well, Islam is not a religion of fighting and war. Islam is a religion of peace and unity. It's a very good religion. And Islam is not against the sophistication. Islam is not against the civilization. Islam is a religion of development.
So we don't have it right now. We did not hope something like that from Islam. It is all, he's trying to say, this is all because of that last 20 years. It was not a real Islam implemented in Afghanistan. That's why we are in the current situation. All the distractions that you can see, all these fightings between the rival factions that you can see, is all, you know, based in one thing, that they are not aware of Islam. Not aware of anything. They are not educated. They are illiterate.
Mullah Rauf rocks back and forth on his floor mat, as if it were a rocking chair. He says the government shouldn't have anything to do with religion. It should build international relations, create jobs, and let the doctors treat the sick, the engineers build, and the mullahs preach. I ask him if he thinks he's seen the last of prison cells, the last of politicians who will put him in jail for his sermons.
Shayad. Shayad.
Maybe.
Maybe.
As the mullah heads out to meet his followers, he points to his sturdy bicycle. It's the only thing in his room, other than a space heater and a pile of well-worn books.
This is all in the last 23 or 25 years that I have gained, is this old bike that I'm just riding the whole Kabul with. And if international community is to help Afghanistan, I might have a better car. So if I have a better car, I can serve you better, I can serve the nation better, I can get to any funeral very faster rather than this bike.
The city of Herat is 1,000 kilometers west of Kabul, on the dry, sandy plateau near Iran and Turkmenistan. Here, the layers of Afghanistan's history peel back, and the past sits up in the dust and comes alive. From everywhere in the city, you can see the shapes of 5 tall towers, like ghosts of tall smokestacks in the blowing dust. They're minarets, enormous stone poles covered with shattered spirals of turquoise and gold tile. A visitor leaves behind the busy street and crosses a courtyard that must be the size of a couple of football fields. Littered with cracked tiles and overgrown weeds, broken benches where, for hundreds of years, students gathered for classes. At one time, there were as many as 20 minarets in this huge courtyard. That was 600 years ago. The 5 that remain are not actually still vertical. They lean at odd angles, weakened by centuries of earthquake and war. They surround a cube-shaped building, a huge and imposing structure with a high round dome. There's a man sweeping dust off the patio around the building. He's Ismail Moda Din. Find out later he's a pharmacist, and he takes care of the place. He welcomes visitors just because he loves it here. You can climb a narrow spiral staircase carved into the rock. This is the tomb of a woman who died in the 1500s, the wife of a ruler whose family conquered most of Asia and made Herat the capital of the empire. Her name was Gaur Shad. She spent her husband's money building a university for 4,000 students. She turned this city into the intellectual and cultural center of the Persian world. It's called the Timurid Renaissance. It lasted 100 years.
This is Gaur Shad.
The remains of Gaur Shad, its patron, its sponsor, are sealed into this tomb. You can squeeze through a passageway and climb onto a big dome. It's completely dark inside. Overhead, there's another dome, and above it, a third one. 3 domes, Ismail shows me, one inside the other, protecting the tomb of Herat's most celebrated citizen.
Timurids ruled the country for 100 years. And their time was one of the brightest time in Afghanistan. And they left behind lots of heritage. I have really studied the history very well, and I don't know anybody after the Timurids that really helped the country.
One man who's been doing what he can is a poet who lives just down the street. When other intellectuals fled decades of war and repression, this man stayed put in Herat, in the shadow of the tomb of Gaur Shad. He spent the dark years giving his son an appreciation for Persian literature. Mohammed Kafash gets up from his carpeted floor to welcome a visitor. Where other people look at the 5 minarets and see the glorious past, Kafash laments the 15 that have been reduced to rubble. He sees the scars where the turquoise tiles have been blasted by gunfire, the pockmarks left by Soviet rockets and tanks. He sees the minarets as a record of war and invasion going back to Genghis Khan, whom he calls Chungizis.
We feel very unfortunate as we look back. Our ancestors built this magnificent city, and it was supposed to continue growing. Unfortunately, Herat has seen mass murder of its residents several times. The Chungizis carried a mass murder on Herat population that left only 13 residents alive. The Timurids, the British, and the Iranians likewise. We just regret why we were so helpless to defend and sustain Herat.
To Mohammad Nasser Kafash, the broken minarets are symbols of weakness, not strength.
They are actually not standing. If they were standing, there would have been thousands of knowledge-thirsty students next to them.
He shows the guest to the door. The western sky is golden in the sunset. He's standing in the shadow of the minaret. He's where he wants to be. And he offers this invitation to his countrymen who left Afghanistan.
I'm hoping that my compatriots who have lived outside Afghanistan, my country will need their assistance in the future. Although the life is a bit hard to live here in Afghanistan compared to Europe or other countries, but if they want to reconstruct Afghanistan, and we can use them.
But who would trade the good life of North America and Europe for bombed-out schools, hospitals, and houses with no water, no power, and no telephones? Rahmatullah Maher has come to Kabul to be the top advisor to the Minister of Foreign Affairs. His wife and adult children are still in the United States.
All your life you belong to somewhere, to somebody, to some place, to some city. And the idea of being stateless, I never forget the pain. I still have the pain. That's why I'm back. You go to a place, you live in a place where you feel that you're somebody. When you go to your hometown, to your country, you have something in common. Like language, like jokes, like your feelings, like your behavior. Even the flag, the new flag makes me happy because it's the flag I'm used to. Black, red, and green was the flag that I'm brought up with. And then the communists and then the new regimes, they kept changing the flag. I wasn't happy with this. Until recently, when I'm back, the old flag is back in place. It's part of me, and I'm part of the flag. It's nostalgia. It brings back to me the memory of old time when the country was much better, when the people were much nicer. After 24 years of war, sometimes I feel that the native people are kind of sick people. They're emotionally sick. And to me, most of them, they look strangers.
His name is Dr. Nazar Muhammad Shahidi, and he is the Deputy Minister of Ministry of Reconstruction, and he's working right here as a Deputy Minister. I know that it might be very hard for those little young children who has grown up in abroad in the United States and European countries, wherever. It might be difficult for them to return, but their parents have to feel responsibility in their shoulders, and this is the time.
The deputy minister stayed in Afghanistan through the hard times. He's still teaching economics at Kabul University to make ends meet. And he has no sympathy for Afghans who are reluctant to return.
Especially I'm talking about those who are talking about the politics and about the humanitarian rights. This is the exact time for them to come and show up. Right? And if they do not come to Afghanistan, they do not return to Afghanistan, the work will be given to someone who is absolutely, who has no education reputation, who is illiterate. So they should feel responsible that this is our duty and job to get back and get the right job. Mm-hmm.
نام ما مصدیق است و تقریبا 30 سال میشه که اینجا کار میکنم با آرشیف رادیو و این آهنگ از استاد سرانگ است که سرتاج موسیقی است و اولین آهنگش است که به نام ای کبک زری بیا با پالوی.
I find Mohammed Sadiq in a studio at Radio Afghanistan. I play him the message I've brought from his old friend Shad Khom, the famous Afghan singer who now lives in Toronto. Sadiq smiles.
من برای شاد کام نامش که رسید من بسیار خوش شدم که شاد کام سه فرزند با
You will hear right now is one of my best friend's song. His name is Shad Khom and let me give him a message through this song that I'm really thankful by having your message and your letter and I'm really missing you and I chose your songs for you especially was about the spring. So this is the song of Shad Khom. It's about 15 years ago.
راست گفتن عشق خوبان آتش است.
Sadiq has had a hard time since his old friend left 10 years ago, dodging rocket fire and bullets from gunmen on the roof of Radio Afghanistan, protecting the archives from the Taliban.
Afghanistan kasi ki zindagi mekone zindagi az o chi khod bashe.
Yes, he says that those who live in Afghanistan, you can ask how kind of, you know, life they have. They are in very bad conditions, in any point of view. For example, he says that I'm really suffering about the life of Afghans. If you want to ask those who are abroad, let me tell them that Afghans have no life in their country. Hope is the only thing that keeps one alive. And we have lived through many years deceiving ourselves that we might have a better day. So we are always hopeful, and if God is willing, one day will be good for us.
Man kujo mo tar ke on mahwash kujo, dil kujo pa hezazino dash kujo. Man kujo mo tar ke on mahwash kujo.
My driver in Herat has a gift for me, a white silk scarf. It has an intricate border embroidered on it, in tiny immaculate stitches, and swirling Persian letters are stitched in orderly rows. I want to meet the person who did this work. She lives down an alley, off the market. She sits in the shade on a maroon-colored Afghan carpet, pulling a tiny needle through a piece of white silk cloth in her lap.
No mazala gul.
My name is Zahra Gul, and I have copied these poems from other people to the scarf for 22 years.
It takes hours of work to make even a small part of one letter. She tells me it took 3 months to embroider the poem into the scarf that Latif just gave me. Her mother taught her embroidery and how to stitch the poems into silk.
Other people wrote them down and I just copied them. The poem you see on the scarf is from Sadi.
Sadi Shirazi was a 14th century Persian poet. Every textbook of Persian literature includes some of his poems. I try several times to get Zahra Gul to read the poem on the scarf. She tells me she can't.
I learned
this by doing this, then I learned how to do it. And my husband was killed, and I have 4 children. I am a hard-working person.
To hold the silk scarf Zahra Gul made is to touch a tradition that goes back generations. But along with that, the woman keeping the tradition alive can't even read the poetry that she's stitched into the scarf. And then it strikes me, it may go back generations, but now, how fragile it is. How easy it would be for this heritage to simply disappear. By the way, the poem on the scarf, loosely translated, is something like this. Son, you have gone away and made a success of yourself. Now, what have you done to make your mother proud?
You've been listening to part 1 of Afghanistan, The Sky Cries Blood on CBC Radio 1.
This special series was first broadcast in April 2002 and is the winner of a Gold World Medal at the 2003 New York Festivals, as well as a UN Gold Plaque. The series was presented by CBC correspondents Connie Watson and David McLaughlin. Sadly, little more than a year after producing the documentaries for the series, David McLaughlin died of a brain tumor. His wife collected his awards on his behalf. Afghanistan, The Sky Cries Blood was produced by Alan Gattell, David Carroll, and Leslie Adams. If you have any comments about today's program, you can reach us through our website at cbc.ca/Sirius. And The Winner is produced by Laurie Allen. I'm Pat Sensen. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.